Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Loosehead Podcast with me, Jeff Neville. On this series of the podcast, I'll be speaking with guests whose careers were impacted through injury. We'll discuss the injuries themselves, the mental side of it, and if those injuries have left any after effects today. But as well as that, we'll be chatting about the highs they enjoyed too, the games that stick out most in their minds and their best memories on the pitch. A different guest will join me every week, and this morning I'm delighted to welcome Niamh Briggs onto the show. Niamh, how are you getting on?
Hi, how are you?
Not too bad. How's life?
Good, yeah. Good morning. Watching New Zealand, Australia there. Let us know three. So, I don't know if you watched it, but it was absolutely class.
I'd say as a back, you must watch Richie Moonga and just think he's different gravy altogether.
Yeah, he's unbelievable. And I used to find it strange when people were clamouring to have Beauden Barrett in there, you know, giving out almost that Richie Moonga was starting against him. And obviously, look, Beauden Barrett's more class, but I've been watching Moonga since he was playing Mitre 10 days, and I think he's class. He's absolutely class.
But that's the thing, they're arguing to have Barrett in, and as a result, all they did was move Barrett to 15 to fit in two world-class players and into that back line.
Yeah, so I think Barrett's a little bit lost back there, to be honest. I think he's thriving at that 10 role, but it's hard to kind of fit them all in, I suppose. You know, when you look at someone like Rico Oni coming off the bench and other lads not even making the squad, it's ridiculous. It's an embarrassment to Rich is how they play, but it was a good match this morning. So starting the day on a high.
From a coaching perspective, like, what an unbelievably good headache that must be to have. Like, who do I start, Richie or Beauden? Like, you know, like,
I know. Yeah, it can be. Sometimes those kind of conversations can be like very difficult, I think, you know, when you have too many. Like, they're probably stacked with two or three world class players at every single position. You know what I mean? If somebody gets injured, somebody else just slots in. Like, it's a good headache, I suppose, but also a hard one because you're trying to keep them all happy too.
How was lockdown 2.0 treating you, I suppose, between everything and especially being a guard? You know, you must be flat out these days.
Yeah, we're incredibly busy in Limerick, but it's harder this time, I think, for people. I think the weather, you know, the evenings are dark, people can't get out and about, and we had just got into a really good groove at rugby and I had got into a really good groove at rehab. So it's another little step knocking it. But it is what it is. Hopefully, you know, we'll get back to playing a little bit of rugby before Christmas in terms of even if you get back training, you kind of take that now at this stage.
Speaking of rugby, in this series of the podcast, I'm going to be talking to players about their highs of playing so far, but also about the injury side of the game. So just so that we're finishing up on a high, I might start off with the injury side of it and maybe get that out of the way first, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of injuries and in terms of, you know, injuries you've suffered throughout the years and stuff, how many did you suffer in total in and around? Do you remember them all or do you just remember kind of the big ones?
No, I'd remember most of them because any time you get one, you're out of rugby for a while. So I've had four knee surgeries, one rupture, PCL, MCL injuries, broken hands, pins in there, broken thumb. And then obviously, you know, they were kind of early on in my career. For a couple of seasons, I was just managing to get back to play rugby with Ireland and then usually pick up an injury in the last game or whatever that would keep me out for another 5 or 6 months. So that was incredibly frustrating. Ray Moran told me back in 2012 to 2013 to retire from rugby in Santry because my knee was absolutely shattered. But I managed to get back from that and get back for the good days, you know, straight after that. You know, I worked really hard in that off season, got back to winning the Grand Slam, and then, you know, kept going to the World Cup in 2014. Obviously, a couple of weeks before that game, I broke my hand pretty badly in a training session. So had that pinned and plated before we went over to France, played that World Cup and got back. And then, just another knee injury at the end of the last game against Scotland in 2015, Six Nations, that I managed to hobble through that game. And then it's probably the beginning to the end, really, after that, because hamstring injury and November Internationals in 2016, tried to rehab it over the Christmas period, and then the week before the Six Nations started, I had to get through that weekend's training session and was doing a bit of it, not a huge amount, was definitely feeling not great, and then tried to push something and then tore it off the bone. So that was a bit of a disaster. And then rehabbed really, you know, went into Santry for a few weeks under Enda King, did like a resident rehab program, tried to learn how to move functionally again, because the injuries weren't really contact injuries. They were all functional movement injuries. So, yeah, did really good work with him and obviously hoped to get back to the World Cup and for the World Cup in 2017. But the week before, tore my Achilles. That was a bit of a disaster. But spending a year, probably a year, maybe 2 years, trying to get back from that injury and been in and out of squads and trying to get myself fit again and then feeling really good at heading into that Munster campaign in 2019, and in the first game, like, shattered my leg, dislocated my ankle. So that's, yeah, I've had a few.
it's amazing. Like, I was chatting to a few players over the last couple of days, and like, I was chatting to Jenny Murphy and Tyler Blaindall and now yourself, like, and even Barry Murphy, like, even just when I asked that question, like, do you remember all the injuries you had? Do you know, people are like, yeah, I did this, then I did that, then the other, then that, I did that. Like, but like, if you chatted to anyone, let's say, who wasn't familiar with rugby at all, but was, let's say, a fan of sport, maybe the lesser extreme sports, I should say, or definitely the lesser contact sports, and you rattled off all these injuries you had just kind of almost nonchalantly, do you know, then they'd be looking at you going like, why do you play this sport? Like, stop.
Yeah, look, I think they've been, majority of them, like the last three or four, have been pretty big and pretty close together. And I think up until then, I always had a focus. I always had a goal. I always wanted to get back for the next big tournament, but also to get back better than what I had been previously. And that was always a really big thing for me. So after the first knee injury, it was about rehabbing as best I could, but also learning as much as I could off the pitch, so that when I got back playing, I was just going to be a better player than what I was when I left it. So For a long time, that drove me. That was enough. Like, and then obviously, the hamstring injury off the bone, the card of the World Cup drove me for there, and that was what I had that in my sights. And then the World Cup, the Achilles injury, broke me physically and mentally. Like, that took me a huge amount of time to get back. And to be fair, have I, you know, mentally recovered from it? I'm not sure, to be honest. There's still days that become incredibly difficult. And then this injury, which was almost like a, oh, here we go again moment. There was no real huge burst of emotion, not like the World Cup injury. I think this one was just a, are you shitting me moment. And that was, and it's been a really, really, really hard road to try and get back from it. I think the injury itself was really big. A second operation is never good when you're trying to get back from something, and then there's the rehab by myself and not with a carrot of anything as such. It doesn't mean that it puts it on the back burner, but it just means that any little bits extra you would have always done, you probably won't do now, and or you probably don't do at the time. That's not saying I don't get up every morning 6 o'clock to get to the gym to get rehab in before I go to work, and don't get it back on a bike or swim pool straight away after work. It's not that. It's just that mentally you're not all in it, because maybe I'm burnt out by it. Maybe I know that I'm, very near the end of my career. Maybe I know that I'm coaching now and I'm loving that. Your targets or your goals change. But this one has been the most horrendous by far, to try and get back from.
In terms of missing the 17 World Cup, and I know you were the captain of that team, heading into the campaign and stuff, missing that, like, I can't imagine what it must be like to miss a World Cup through injury. Like, I can't even imagine what it's like to be named for a World Cup, let alone to miss one. But I mean, in terms of missing that World Cup through injury, did it make it, like, I know it was shit, like, but did it make it so much worse because it was something out of your control? Like, if you weren't selected, you could at least go out and play better. Or you could at least train harder and you might still get a call up.
Yeah.
But because it was an injury, was it a case of this is the worst?
Yeah. The thing was, I was always running a fine line. So when I did my hamstring in January, the end of January, I was always going to be running a fine line to make it back in terms of being back fit and running and playing rugby. So we sat down with the medical team and we decided the rugby would take a back seat, and basically I would be fit and ready to go by the time the first game against Australia came. So really, I was only supposed to be in rugby like in rugby training the week before, if that makes any sense. So while I woke up to the camps, I'd just run on the sideline, or I do walk bike sessions and hard gym sessions, or boxing sessions or whatever it was for hits, but I was doing very little rugby. So I had to complete two running sessions the week beforehand. So I completed the one on a Tuesday night, and I came away from it buzzing. In UL, I was like, yeah, I'm back. That's it. Brilliant. I'm actually like, my hamstring felt great. I managed to keep up with some, you know, the Irish girls that had been in that pod in training in Limerick, and I didn't look out of place, and I felt good. So I was really buzzing. And then Thursday, I went out to complete the second one and just went to push off the line and got the pop. And yeah, I think I definitely went into a bit of denial at the start. I was like, oh, this is grand, like, it's fine, it's going to be fine, it's going to be fine. And then Saturday, I tried to do a kicking session, just couldn't put my foot in my boot. And you know, then that something's not good. So, yeah, probably the next week, you know, the squad had been already announced and I had done all that part of it. And I had felt good Tuesday night. So I fully felt like I was going to be in that squad. And I fully felt that I would be playing against Australia the week and a half later. So, yeah, look, it was... You know, I went and spoke to Kieran Cosgrave. He was the doctor of the RFU at the time. And he was like, look, it's hanging on by a thread. Like, basically, your Achilles is hanging on by a thread. One, you could get through a game. One sprint could absolutely rupture you. And I can't tell you whether you get back running after that. So I was there. That's fine. Yeah, I'll play. If I rupture in the warm-up, at least I've got there. That's kind of where I was thinking. Like, you know, at least all that hard work, that standing on the sidelines over the summer, that running on the sidelines while the girls are playing rugby, at least that'll have worked, you know, it would have made it worth it. And yeah, look, the RFU, to be fair to them, were like, absolutely not, we can't take that that into our hands. So yeah, it was awful. I think you go into robotic mode almost, to just punch your feelings down to the end of your boots, because you rock up to watch them play games at a home World Cup where you're supposed to be captain, where you were supposed to be going out in the swan song, and you just kind of, you're there but you're not there, if that makes any sense. So yeah, look, it was a pretty rough couple of weeks, and the months afterwards are really hard too. But I got back obviously for the final Six Nations, but I didn't really get back. I think that was just a car crash of trying to push my body to be in a place where it wasn't supposed to be, and not wanting to not be involved, I suppose, because you want to make up for the time you lost. But it was incredibly difficult, and something that I probably still today I'm trying to come to terms with, to be honest. I used my family and my friends to support a lot, but to be fair, there was, you know, I couldn't talk about it for a long time because it's just on the edge of tears all the time, which is probably a very girly thing to say, but I was not at all.
I can only imagine.
I wasn't able to deal with it. I tried to just rehab as best I could to get back so that I could play again, but I think it's only now, as I'm kind of trying to digest this and recover from this injury, that a lot of those emotions come back up again, you know.
So missing the 2017 Six Nations, you had the carrot of the World Cup, and you talked earlier about the injury now and not having that carrot to get you back. But after missing that World Cup through injury, were you in the same place maybe mentally as you are now? Or was it a case of, look, I've missed the World Cup, but I still have, you know, maybe the upcoming Six Nations, or I still have games coming up with Munster?
I wasn't really in a place basically after that World Cup to be able to be like, yeah, I'm going to push for the next Six Nations, because I didn't really know if I wanted to play again, to be honest. I fell out of love with rugby a lot that, you know, August, September, October. And then, you know, speaking to people and my family and friends and stuff like that, it almost comes into, well, stubborn mode. You know, I don't want to walk out on such a low. I don't want to leave playing. So you just get back into the gym and you get back trying to rehab another injury, I suppose. And to be fair, I was in with Mark Beggs at Munster at the time, and he was excellent, and he really, really helped me just in terms of, you know, every session that I did he was there, which was probably something different. As amateurs, we wouldn't have had that kind of support, I suppose, all along. So you know, every gym session I did, he was there. Every running session I did, he was there. And that was a huge thing for me. At least then, you know, you could see progressions, because sometimes when you're, sometimes when you're coming back from a huge injury, the goals or the targets you set yourself, it's very difficult to see them. So, you know, it might be a case of to be able to do, you know, 10 calf raises or lift a certain weight, and you feel like you can't get there or you're never going to get there. Whereas somebody that's there and they're observing it and they're able to push you and they're the ones that can see those little improvements, that's really, like, that can help you huge. And they also become your little support structure in terms of, you know, that kind of, maybe not a sport psychologist, but they're the ones that are listening to you bitching, moaning, or you know, picking you up when you need it, or, you know, trying to simmer your hopes down when you've had a really good running session or a really good gym session. It's just trying to row you back in a small bit. And so while, you know, I've had some brilliant physios, I've had to have some brilliant physios, to be fair, to help me out over the years. The best ones are the ones that are there for you physically, but also emotionally and mentally, I think.
You touched on it there a second ago. So in regards to support from the IRFU and support, like, in terms of physio, medical, all that, how good was that? Or do you feel that it was done par, let's say, with the men's?
Oh, no, they were brilliant. People can give out what they want about the IRFU in terms of certain aspects, but for me personally, through all those injuries, the care that I got, there was never a question, and it was the best of the best that I had ever experienced. So I most 100% would not have got to 50 odd caps or whatever it was without that, because I was picking up really stupid injuries from a very early stage, and they backed me. And so yeah, look, it was brilliant to be, like, from them. You know, we had Ulrich McCarthy back in 2012, 2013, 2014 to Emma Galvin at the last World Cup, and everybody in between, they all played a huge role. And it was brilliant.
In terms of finding time to rehab and, like, having a full-time job at the same time, was it a case of you just have to, like, how did you find the time to do that?
You just have to be really, really organized. You know, you'd be in sessions from 6 a.m, 6:30 to going to work for 8 or 8:30, and then sessions in the evening, be it a condition session or something like that. So, and then you just go home and you fall into bed. So you don't really have much time for anything else, but it's not really, like, I never really saw it as a sacrifice. I never really liked to associate that word with playing rugby for Ireland. I think it was a choice, and I chose to do that, and in a real perverse way, I loved it. I loved the structure of it. I loved the fact that I knew every day getting up in the morning that I had an opportunity to make myself A, better in terms of my physical condition, but also be a better rugby player. And that drove me a huge amount. And when you go into rehab with, or in a facility like the HBC in Munster, and you come across all the lads and they're doing the exact same thing that you're doing, and you're taking little bits and nuggets of information off them, you know, it's brilliant. It gives you that little lift, it gives you that pep in the step, and yeah, it just makes you a better player, I think. So from that point of view, it was never really an issue time-wise. You just realised very quickly that if you were jumping on board with this whole hog, then you just didn't have a lot of time for anything else.
But, like, you mentioned seeing the lads inside in the gym as well, like, and they're going through the same thing, but, like, they're there for maybe an hour, 2 hours, whatever, but then they go home, like, they don't go to work. So to have that self-drive, or that discipline, I suppose, to make sure that you are doing that day in, day out, like, that takes huge mental strength as well.
Yeah, but when you know, when there's someone going with you, it's good. Like, you know, at the moment, obviously with COVID and stuff, you're even by yourself a lot, and I find that a lot more difficult this time around than I did when I was in the height of it, because you always had somebody going with you. So whether it was physio or the girls that were coaching in the pod or training in the pod with you, you always had somebody with you, so you didn't really mind. And big driver for me was, you know, I obviously used to, like, you want to be the best that you can be. When I started playing rugby with Ireland, I wanted to be the best rugby player ever. And you look at other people and other teams, you look at other players that you admire and you respect, and you know, there was mornings where I didn't want to get out of bed. You'd be thinking, well, do this person want to get out? You know, they're not alone to be lying in bed. So that would just drive you to basically go in and do it. And so, yeah, it wasn't really that difficult, to be honest, because the carrot of playing for Ireland at the end of it was always way too big to kind of stand in the way of anything else. I think now it's obviously very difficult and very different, a different mindset, a different way of trying to, I suppose, rehab and motivate myself to be able to do it. And that's a hard thing to do.
So how are you managing that over Zoom or over lockdown and that?
Yeah, so the first lockdown was obviously a little bit more stringent, so there was no contact at all really as such, whereas this lockdown they're able to work away, so it's not too bad, so I can still get in. And the first one was fine, I think, because I had just had a second surgery, so I had to get a plate put into my leg and a tightrope. There was big complications after the first one, so I set up a small home gym in my mum's house because I was rehabbing back home in Abside, Nungarvan. And a lot of it was body weighted stuff of movements as opposed to any sort of weight strength work at that stage. So it was fine. And then set my bike up on a turbo and was able to just pedal away for a long time watching episodes on Netflix. So so from that point of view, it actually wasn't that bad. You did miss the hands-on contact in terms of soft tissue work, but the actual rehab stuff, it was okay because of where I was at that stage. I think had I been longer in, had I needed strength work, I needed a gym, it would have been a bit more difficult.
So I think that's maybe enough of the lows for the moment, do you think?
Fact.
In terms of the highs, like 62 caps, 2 World Cups, 2 Six Nations, 1 was a slam, top point scorer, first Ireland team to beat France, England, New Zealand, you've captained them, you've captained Munster. I mean, you must, like, I know there have been setbacks, like, but you must be like immensely proud of everything, like.
Yeah, obviously.
Everything so far. Sorry, I'd like to stick that.
Yeah, it's difficult when you're still kind of in it. You know, I've not made a decision whether I will or won't play again. So, until I've made up my mind about that, then I kind of find it hard to sit down and think about all those things because, they were unbelievable days. There were unbelievable days with some brilliant people, and they're the memories that I cherish. Not so much, obviously, the on-field stuff has been brilliant, but the friends that I made and the crack that we used to have, they're the big memories, are the big, big highs for me.
How different are the setups now compared to 13 years ago?
Ridiculous. They're like worlds apart. When I came into the senior setup at the start, Fiona Seed had been coaching with Donal from Cork, and it was a bit mad. I didn't really know enough about rugby, so I was really raw. So I just knew that the ball had to go backwards, and I just had to tackle what was in front of me. But I didn't really get anything else, so I got pinged about 4 times in my first game because I didn't roll away, and I was like, I don't understand. But it's worlds apart now in terms of setup, professionalism, the organization of Munster Rugby have really taken the women's game on board. The caliber of people involved now in terms of S&C, physios, coaches, it's unbelievable. Even to where you train, you know, we've trained for years and years in Fermoy, which is, like, the pitch is probably unreal, like, in terms of their own floodlights and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, now you're in UL and Thomond Park and Irish Independent Park, and, you know, that those little things mean a huge amount to players, especially as they're bursting onto the scene. And I think the organisation behind it, you know, I've been really fortunate to play with some unbelievable players in Munster and to be coached by some brilliant coaches even in those early days. But the organisation, behind it in terms of nutrition, S&C, physio, you know, it's now at a level that, you know, it needs to be fair. So, really different. Like, from the gear we were talking about the other day, you get a bag of gear from Munster 10, 12 years ago and everything would be triple XL because it would be what was left in the stores. Whereas now you get gear with that fits you properly. So, like, small things like that, I think, do help, and they give a good impetus to the squad and to the girls that are there. But the biggest thing for me that's changed is the caliber of players. There's now these 18, 19 year old girls that are coming into squads, and I got involved coaching Munster women's senior team over the summer just as a skills technical coach, and these 18, 19 year olds, it's scary what they could be and can be with a little bit more belief and good coaching. They're phenomenal athletes, and makes you almost a little bit jealous because their training age at 18, 19 is 5 or 6 years, whereas I didn't start rugby until I was 21. So that's the biggest thing. Caliber of player has been so much better.
Not only that, but those 17, 18, 19 year olds, like, I know Rugby Academy Ireland are setting up a representative under 20 side as well. So, I mean, even just to have that as an outlet, like, even for the first game, you know, you just apply to go there. Like, you know, you don't have to be picked. You can put yourself forward. Like,
yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a brilliant little initiative, and it needs to be done, to be fair, because even with Boas this year and last year, you know, we've had a couple of really young 18-year-olds come in from Ennis Rugby, and you're thinking, oh, I'll just blood them in, you know, train with us and get them into involved in match day squads, and, you know, to get a bit of game time, brilliant. If they don't, at least they're learning. And next minute you put them into a train session and they're absolutely lighting it up, and you've no choice but to play them every week because they're brilliant. And so it's brilliant to see these young girls coming up. It gives me a huge lift coaching them, that they're that young, they actually, like, they don't care that they're going to club training and tackling junior Kira Griffin, Irish captain. They just want to be playing rugby, and so it's brilliant. And yeah, it gives me a huge boost that to see them and what they can do. And then you go against clubs that have similar girls, similar age. We played Kerry a couple weeks ago, and the centre, Maeve McGilligott, who's the same age as the two girls that are playing, 18-year-olds. And you're thinking, oh my God, like, these girls could all be playing for Ireland in a couple of years' time, and they're class. So yeah, the next generation coming down, and something like that under-20s Rugby Academy Ireland team will help bridge the gap between, you know, 18, 19 and senior, but also it'll give them an opportunity to train with really good players, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. So, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so some clubs, when you're 18 or 19 and you're coming from a development club, you're the best player on the team, so you do everything. So you're the runner, you're the kicker, you're the tackler, you're the poacher. And when you take them out of that environment and put them into an environment where they're playing with players of similar ability, that's then where you see where the cream will rise to the crop, and those that will be able to adapt to a game in senior level much quicker than those that are the main player in their club will find it really hard, because,
you know, they're getting more done in less time. You know, they're just
100%. And when you're doing everything in a game, you don't learn enough, because you're doing, your head is too stuck in it, so it's very difficult for you to be able to understand what's going on around you. So it's got game knowledge, game appreciation for those 18, 19, 20-year-olds that were going to something like that, and it's going to be brilliant for them.
Just to get back to yourself, and I want to reference the 2013 calendar year, I suppose. You know, you had that slam in 2013, and you were named Guinness Rugby Women's Player of the Year. And what are your abiding, I know you said, like, it's the people who you remember the most, but, like, what would your abiding memories be of, let's say, that slam?
Definitely the win against England.
Well, that has to be
that
up
was
there,
huge, because we'd never done it before. But I don't know if you ever hear about this psychology term called flow. Team gets into this thing where they come into a state of mind where, I know it sounds ridiculously nerdy and outrageous, but for that whole campaign, it was just like something like a table had turned or a page in the book had turned, and we all felt like that we could win every game we played. Well, I certainly did anyway. So the Wales game, that first game in that slam, you know, only for Ali Miller, literally got a toe to a ball to kick it out before the Welsh player dives on it to score. And then we go up the pitch and score in the last minute. You know, those fine margins, you think, oh my God, we got out of jail here. You know, we didn't play well, but we won. I've never been in a position where we've not played well and won before. And then the next game goes into it and we play better and we win. You think, we could be on something here. And that day against England, I know Ali's talking about before about having dreams of scoring hat-trick tries against England the night before, but I don't know if that really happened. But during that whole game, even when we were getting pummeled on our line for the second half, a period in the second half, I never felt like we were going to lose it. And that feeling of, I suppose, invincibility, or feeling of every time we take the pitch, we're going to win, is unbelievable. Like, it is the confidence that oozes through people, the off-field morale and spirit culture is brilliant, and everybody's enjoying each other's company because you're winning and everybody's in good form and everybody's playing. And so, yeah. And then obviously the Italy game, day before, sun is shining, unbelievably gorgeous. And then the next day you wake up and it's snowing and there's no grass on the pitch. And the ability to eke out a win in that those sort of conditions, with a load of people supporting us from home, was unbelievable.
Is that what you'd remember most, kind of that, just that kind of, just that confidence, I suppose?
Yeah, 100%. And I'm usually really good to remember parts of games, and like, I could tell you scores, and I could tell you the times of the scores. I could tell you who was playing, who we were playing against. For that campaign, all I just remember really are snippets of different games, all right, but mostly the air of confidence that we had in each other.
I think that's kind of a signal, though, that you are living in the moment. And like Jenny Murphy talked about it like that, how Goose brought you out for a few pints and a few, you know, purple snacks. And he just said, essentially, like, just enjoy it because you're in the middle of it, kind of a thing. Like, but I think if you're remembering every little inkling of it or every little, you know, touch, like you said, you're not really focused on the overall game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. Easily, yeah. Because I remember when in the English game, you know, at halftime, I think we were 15-0 up, I think it was 15-0 up, and we're all kind of looking around the dressing room, and we're all like, and everyone's like, okay, so when do they actually, you know, come out and hammer us? Because we've never been in this position before. And Fee and Goose are just like, don't give them their purple patch. Don't allow them to get back. You know, don't allow them to gain any parity. And you know, you'll win this game. Like, they're not, you know, they're not like infallible. Like, you know, we can go out and we can win this. And then during the second half, you're like, okay, they're not coming. Why aren't they coming? You know, because you're so used to. I had been in a position before, and I think it was like 2011 when we played them in St. 2010. We played them in St. Mary's RFC, and we were like 8-0 up or something at half time, and we were playing really, really well. And then they, like, it was like 30-odd points to 8, you know, in the second half. Like, you know, they always had that ability to be able to come back, and one or two scores was kind of felt like it wasn't going to be enough. And then, we just pushed on and got another score or two. So, yeah, look, it was definitely a campaign of living in the moment, I think. And little things that went our way that probably hadn't before. And that's a huge thing. You always need a little bit of luck on your side, I suppose.
The following year then, in the 2014 World Cup, you beat New Zealand, you're named in the Dream Team, you're Player of the Year for the second year running. And again, I know you don't you say that you remember the people the most and stuff like that, but like, you must have some good memories of that year, is that?
Yeah, unbelievable. I think obviously that Six Nations, we came down to our last game again, so we were in or thereabouts to win an under Six Nations, and that was really good. And then obviously the World Cup, I think preparation was brilliant for us all. I broke my hand the week before and then had to get it pinned in, but that was a bit of a disaster. But got to the World Cup, and it was just a really good buzz within the squad. You know, there'd be like Claire Malloy was the resident DJ, and she'd have ridiculous tunes playing from early in the morning to halftime and way into matches. And you look around the dressing room, and it was a happy dressing room. Girls would be dancing away kind of in the corner to themselves as they were trying to prepare for the game. And the night before New Zealand game, Goose walked into the team room and everybody's standing on chairs singing Frozen's Let It Go because we'd watched Frozen together, and small things like that. And, you know, there's so many funny stories from off the pitch moments in that World Cup that I don't think we have ever been since, probably, and never before that, been in such a good place as a squad during that time. You know, everything that we asked for off the pitch, Gemma Crowley was the manager at the time. She was unbelievable. She's brilliant, and she's gone on to work with, you know, Olympics and Lions Tour since. But she, you know, herself, Goose, Greg McWilliams, Brax, these lads, we never had to we never felt like we weren't being backed or looked after, and I think that was a big thing too. And so yeah, it was just a brilliant tournament for that. And I don't know how we got to it since the pitch of that kind of that belief and that enjoyment in each other's company, since, to be honest. And that's not to say, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It was just in that moment, 13, 14 was a culmination of all the hard work from the previous World Cup, if that makes any sense. So yeah, we had got into a really good space. I think that was definitely a big memory from that time.
I remember that New Zealand game. I don't know what happened. I think the TV or something in the sitting room broke or whatever it was. Like, but there was about four of us around a little TV in the kitchen, and literally like the last 10 minutes, I don't think myself and three of the lads have ever been closer together physically. Like, it was just cheek to cheek trying to watch that last few minutes. But what was that final whistle like, being the first team to beat New Zealand?
Yeah,
first Irish
huge.
Team, I should say.
Yeah, it wasn't really a case that it was the first Irish team. That wasn't the first abiding moment. The Women's World Cup is run similar to the 20s. So unless you top your group, you don't get out of it. So we'd obviously played the USA first, and then New Zealand, and then it was going to be Kazakhstan. So you'd expect us to win the last game. So it was more of, oh my God, we just got to a World Cup semi-final. And that was probably the biggest thing. And then, yeah, I think, and then your reality hit. Oh shit, we just beat New Zealand. So yeah, but it was more a progression to the tournament for me, definitely. I think to get to that stage was unbelievable. And yeah, that was a brilliant day, to be fair.
And then in 2015, then kind of continuing and captaining Ireland to a Six Nations Championship then as well. Like, I mean, that's three very, very, I know injury aside, but they're three very good years, personally.
Yeah, huge. I think that was a big surprise to be chosen as captain for me. It wasn't really something that I would have thought really much about it before I went into that campaign. So nonetheless, I was delighted and honoured, and it was probably the biggest moment of my rugby career, really, because it's a pretty cool thing to have in your back pocket, I suppose. But yeah, look, it was difficult. It was a difficult kind of year because we were transitioning from, you know, a huge chunk of the squad, you know, retiring after that World Cup. But it wasn't really that. It was a huge chunk of big leaders, you know, Fee Coughlin, Grace Davitt, Lynn Cantwell. Joy Neville had retired after 2013. So Tania Rosser had come in to that World Cup squad and then stayed on for 2015. But it was just, I felt like it was a huge chink missing in terms of leadership. And you know, they really were the standard bearers for Irish rugby. You know, Fee Coughlin was an unbelievable captain, but she set the tone in everything that she did in terms of, you know, how she trained and how she played. And you take them out of it, you know, you're missing, you know, it takes a while for a squad to be able to probably replace them or refill them or to find your own niche, your own way to go about things. But so for us to be able to win that 2015 Six Nations, having lost at home to France, was really big for us. I think that was a really big statement for us coming off the back of the 2014, missing, you know, those players and a new management. I think so. Yeah, it was brilliant. It was so good.
You said that you were in transition, but you still won a Six Nations Championship. Like, I mean, that's not something, I don't think that's something you can just kind of say, oh yeah, we were, you know, we did well to win it. Like, I mean, to lose those players you've mentioned and to still go out and win a Six Nations Championship, like, that's huge.
No, it was unbelievable. And that was definitely my big moment coming home. So we flew home that night from Scotland, and I remember sitting on the plane thinking, you know, obviously delighted that we won, but thinking as a squad, how far now can we go? Because we've, as you say, we were kind of in transition. We were still trying to get used to the new coaching setup. And yeah, so I was really excited for what was going to come in the future.
Between the 2013 Slam, the 14 triumphs, I suppose, and the same with the 15, there must have been some nights out in between them.
Yeah, there was. Look, I'm quieter off the pitch. I don't really. So I think I don't have a huge amount of regrets, to be fair, not even the injuries, because I think they're part and parcel of who I am and my makeup. But I think I wish I enjoyed the wins, the big moments more. I wish I celebrated them better than what I did. I think I was so intense on and off the pitch that there was moments I was just exhausted by the time we reached our goal. I think that I found them really difficult to enjoy them. I think to be fair, and that's brutally honest, I didn't. They weren't something that I actively didn't. I didn't want to celebrate them. I was just so fatigued mentally from maybe pressure I put on myself, or pressure to be the best, or pressure to try and perform at that level. But yeah, like days leading into game weeks were awful. Like I'd be a bundle of nerves and filled with anxiety and dread that I wouldn't play well. And then, so by the time we got to win games and win big moments, I usually was one of the first in bed because I was just mentally fatigued from it all.
So in regards to all those wins and those big occasions, would you say there was a bigger sense of relief than joy?
Yeah, look, I think so. I don't know whether it's, you know, pressure that you put on yourself to be the best, or the win itself, or the process of trying to get there. I think, you know, very intense on and off the pitch. And the game weeks for me were always really difficult because they were usually filled with a little bit of excitement, but a bit more anxiety and dread, I think. And so, yeah, look, usually after those, and it wasn't because I didn't want to be out there. I think I was just so mentally exhausted after those big moments, I think. And yeah, look, I just wasn't a Flea Coughlin type of FOMO player where she wouldn't be the last to go to bed every night because she was afraid of missing out. I was more usually the first one in the bed because I think I was just so mentally spent from the journey as opposed to the outcome, if that makes any sense.
No, absolutely, yeah. And I'm sure it's not just yourself. Like, there's tons of players who have that sense of pressure or put that pressure on themselves as well and feel that relief. Because I can't remember who it was. I was reading an autobiography, I don't know, a long time ago, but it was an international player anyway, and he spoke about how after the game he's in the dressing room just for a couple of minutes thinking, right, I can enjoy this, but then straight away he's clicking into the next job up kind of a thing, and not allowing himself that sense of, like you said, enjoyment, I suppose, more than relief.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and look, my family are great. They came to all the games and home and away, so they definitely did the enjoying for me, I think. And but yeah, no, that was a huge thing. I think even on the good days, you know, the moments in the dressing room afterwards, you know, where you'd sit there for a few minutes and you'd be spent, I think, mentally as much as physically. And yeah, I think for me, it was a lot of it was, you know, maybe moments in the game that I feel like I didn't do well would play in my mind big time until I got to go and try and rectify them. And that didn't have to be a match. It could be the next time I trained or, but yeah, look, we play for a while, you know, a lot of our games are Friday night lights in Ashburn, and I would be in the team room at 2 or 3 in the morning, hiding underneath the table or a chair with an iPad trying to watch the game. And that was kind of usually found it very difficult to sleep after games, and but also too tired to be able to go and celebrate them, I think. And so yeah, it was just a caught in a space where definitely relief, but also a space, it's hard to kind of explain it, but you know, you're sitting there and while everybody's delighted and you're delighted that you won, you know, you're thinking back about the past that you may have, you know, didn't go to hand, and or the tackle you missed, or for me, the kicks that didn't go over the bar or didn't get good enough, you know, clearance from and stuff like that. So it was a huge amount of looking back as opposed to next job too. There was a big element of that.
So I just have a few listener questions to finish up with, if you're all right with that. Okay.
No
hard ones. Yeah. The first one comes from Lauren Fitzgerald, and she was wondering what the process was like for your first Ireland call-up.
Yeah, it's still kind of the same, to be fair. You just get an email to say that you're involved. And I was in college at the time, working part-time in the local bar here in Abbeyside, and the email came through that evening while I was working. So so that's kind of it. It was an email, and then you reply to it to say that you're available to train. Like, who wouldn't be? And you're delighted. And then the the schedules and stuff come a couple of days afterwards of where you have to be, at what time, what you wear, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
The latest question comes from Jimmy O'Farta, and he was wondering, missing out on Ireland selection, was there any communication made, or was it just a case of finding out on the day?
No, to be fair, I had had a conversation with Adam Griggs the day before the squad was being released, and just said, look, I'm not going to take you, and basically that was kind of it, really. So there was a, you know, an open-ended, keep working hard, you go back in for the Six Nations type of thing. But then there was no communication then, obviously, for Six Nations, because that's not really the protocol. I didn't expect any kind of communication at that stage, because we've always been, you know, if there's a movement in and around the squad, like, so if you go from starting to bench or bench to be out of the 23, that's when communication happens in and out of squads and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, no, to be fair, I'd had a conversation with him at the start September, at the start of the season for those November internationals. So I'm not gonna take you this time. So you just have to put your head down, keep trying to improve as a player and hopefully get back in, but didn't work out that for me.
I imagine you're given work ons though, and like things to look to improve on, were you?
No, it was more a case of we're just not going to take you. These are the moments that we thought you did well in the Interpro series, and these are the moments that we didn't think you did well in. But go away and play with your club, and we'll keep an eye in, and if it warrants coming back in, it does, and if it doesn't, type of thing. So yeah, look, there was no you can't get emotional about these things, you know, it's top level sport, it's ruthless, and so I 100% respect his opinion and what he thought, irrelevant of whether I believed I was good enough to be in there or not. That wasn't I didn't come away out of it sour with him or anything like that. It was never a case of that. I fully respected it. I was obviously incredibly disappointed for me and not to be involved, but I fully respected his opinion at the time, I suppose.
It's like the Godfather. It's nothing personal, just strictly business.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, at that level, you know, you look at like those top managers, you know, Joe Schmidt and even just the All Blacks or Brian Cody in hurling, you know, you've got to have a ruthless edge in you, and I fully respect that. And now as I'm on that coaching ladder, it's definitely something that, you know, you learn lots of things from snippets of coaches, things that go well and things that don't. And for me, the ability to be able to communicate openly and honestly with players is one that I'll definitely take with me.
The last question actually refers to coaching, and it comes from Louise O'Connor. And she was wondering, coaching Munster women and coaching the under-18s and coaching Bows, are you finding the same fulfilment coaching that you would from playing?
Not at the start, no, I think. But now, the longer I'm in it, the more invested I'm in it. I'm enjoying different parts of it. So I kind of separated for the UL Bows under-18s sector. It's the ability of the newer girls that I love to see their improvement. So it's not really the internationals that you get a lot of fulfillment out of, it because at club level, they should be the best. It's the newer girls, the under-18 girls, seeing them improve week on week in gives me a huge buzz. I absolutely love seeing it. And then the ability for everybody to train and get something out of it. So it's very difficult in women's rugby to try and do out a session or coach players. So you have players that have never played before, and then you have international players, and you've got to try and come up with something that everybody comes away from training feeling fulfilled, that they have learned something, that they've got better at something, and that they've enjoyed it. So that balance can be really difficult. And then the Munster women's stuff I really enjoyed this year, because it was not really proper, like you weren't in the coaching for the whole session. It was just skills technical stuff that I had started with Mike Pettman. He's the new skills technical coach for the Munster branch, so the whole thing. So I've come in under his wing a little bit and learned so much from him. So I loved that kind of aspect, because it was very specific. So every session we went in with a specific basic skill, so either catch pass, the ability to catch properly, you know, the tackle area, the ability to find space. And so I really enjoyed that. So it was very different to the Bose on reading stuff where I was invested in the whole session, whereas this was just snippets of sessions. And so, yeah, look, I really enjoyed it. So, look, nothing's going to give you the same fulfillment as playing and training. That's a given. But for me, coaching is becoming very close to it at the moment because I'm really, really enjoying it.
A lot of people who coach and play say that being a coach makes them a better player.
I'm different. When I played, I was very intense. I was very cutthroat. I was very unaccepting of bad standards. I think the girls used to tell me I had a look, and then they didn't really need to say anything, and they got a look, and yeah, sorry, like, we'll, you know, endeavour to do better type of thing. Now that I've taken a step back from that and I'm coaching, I find myself to be definitely not as intense or cutthroat. I think you encourage players to make mistakes because you want them to grow and to get better. And so I've definitely mellowed a lot, I think, and found that balance of expecting high standards, but also being able to not be as harsh, I think, for sure.
Well, look, that's it for me. Thanks a million for taking the time to come on and being so open and honest about everything. Like, I really appreciate it.
Thanks a million. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of your podcast, so I was delighted.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a million.
Well, that's it from me today, folks. Thanks a million for listening. And if you enjoyed it, make sure to share it, subscribe, follow, and tune into the next episode. Thanks a million and good luck.